Hello, Houston. We look so cool and relaxed. This is following about 25 minutes of frantic activity. My problem being that the visuals are getting so rich and luscious in the course that we can't find any way to get them from my computer to your screen. And that's what we've been fighting. So we're going to have a few lumps today, but hopefully we can show you most of what we want to do, what we want to talk about. We're going to go to PowerPoint and show you, pick up on the diagram that we were working on last time, because I kind of rushed through the last little bit. What we were talking about was the transduction process, that is the way in which the physical movement of the air is converted into neural energy. And this is the key diagram in your simple psych book that will show you specifically what's involved. If we unroll the cochlea and then cut it crosswise and look end on in, you can see there the various tracks that are involved in the signals coming in. The signals are inbound, on the vestibular canal, and they're outbound on the tympanic canal. The vestibular canal is the top of the three canals. That's where the stirrup of the middle ear is mounted. So when the stirrup pushes in, the fluid in the tympanic canal reacts. And in fact, everything in the cochlea reacts, because somewhere along the middle canal, the power is transferred to the bottom outbound canal, which is the tympanic canal. So it's a kind of a reciprocal relationship between the two. And the real action is in the middle area. The important document there, or the important element, is what's called the basilar membrane, which is the one which separates the bottom or tympanic canal from the central canal. And that bottom canal or basilar membrane vibrates when your ear is being stimulated by sound waves. Mounted on the basilar canal, and I'm oversimplifying what's called the organ of Corti, which is the area where this transduction conversion into neural impulses takes place. But in essence, there are hair cells mounted on that basilar membrane and projecting out into the center canal over the hair cells are what is called the tectorial membrane. The tectorial membrane does not move, but the hair cells attached to the basilar membrane move up and down whenever the basilar membrane moves. So the net result is that anytime a wiggle comes along on the basilar membrane, it jams those hair cells up against the underside of the tectorial membrane and shears them. It causes them to bend, essentially. When those hair cells bend, it stimulates the cell, and that puts a signal onto the auditory nerve. So in essence, the question then is, how and why does that basilar membrane vibrate? And we've got a couple of answers to provide for you to that also. In essence, what is involved is one of two different theories, and actually a compromise between them. One theory argues that what's actually going on is that the entire basilar membrane is vibrating in sympathy with the waves, with the energy that are coming in along it. The problem with that theory is that there's a pretty obvious upper margin, and that is there's no neuron in the body that can operate as much as 20,000 times a second. So there's no way that any neuron could keep up with the entire basilar membrane in accord with the frequency or telephone theory, which is suggesting the entire thing vibrates. So another idea, well, let me back up. One compromise that was suggested by Weaver and Bray in 1930 was that maybe it's a volley. Maybe what happens is when the entire basilar membrane is vibrating very fast, cell A fires and then recycles. In the meantime, cell B fires and recycles. Then cell C fires and recycles. And then cell D fires and recycles, and so forth. So that by the time you get back to cell 1, it has recycled and is ready to fire again. And the point being that if you then have a volley like 1, 2, 3, 4, that causes yet another cell to fire, which says, okay, high frequency. Okay? In other words, if a volley occurs, if 1, 2, 3, 4 fire, that causes number 5 to fire, and only if number 5 fires do you experience it as a higher frequency tone. That would allow the volley, I should put it the other way around, the volley theory would allow the frequency theory to provide an explanation all the way up through the range of frequencies. However, there turns out to be a simpler mechanism. And that is what's called the place theory, which was originally proposed actually by Helmholtz back in the latter 18, early 1900s. The basic idea that he's arguing is exactly like the phenomena that you may have observed in a rope. If in elementary school you ever pulled a jump rope with a friend real tight, one of you held on as tight as you could and the other one did this, you could set up a standing wave in the rope itself. What Helmholtz argues is that along the Basler membrane is vibrating just like one of those ropes. That is, that there's a wave, a sine wave in the Basler membrane. Problem then is that if you remember what that rope looked like when you're doing this and causing that sine wave to occur, is there are two points of maximum vibration. That is, the rope is essentially doing this. So there are really two points of maximum vibration. Where is the Basler membrane supposed to react? Got a solution for you. If you remember, the cochlea is not only coiled, it gets smaller as you get to the end. So what happens is that the actual shape of the Basler membrane is triangular. Okay? When a triangular object vibrates, it does not have a clean sine wave side view. It has rather, one end has a larger wave and the other end has a smaller wave. So in essence, the triangular nature of the Basler membrane, when it vibrates, causes it then to create a point of maximum vibration. That's what's diagrammed on the bottom half of the diagram that you see here. That is, what we're showing you is the vibration of the Basler membrane in triangular form. The point being that there is a point of maximum vibration for any particular vibration which is causing it to wiggle in sympathy. So the place theory argues that it's really the point of maximum vibration anywhere along the Basler membrane that produces sound for us. Well, we've got two theories. Who's correct? Well, the answer is, it turns out that they both are. And I'm fumbling for the exact frequency here, up to essentially 400 cycles per second, von Bakasy proposed that the frequency theory operates. In other words, up to about a little bit below A on a piano, A above middle C on a piano, the entire Basler membrane is vibrating in frequency with whatever sound is coming in. Above about 5,000 cycles per second, it is the place theory. That is, there's simply a point of maximum vibration somewhere along the Basler membrane. And in between roughly 400 and 5,000 cycles per second, you have both theories operating. So there's essentially an overlap phenomenon, which is doubly interesting because of the fact that that's also the frequencies that cover most of the tones that you and I emit when we're talking to each other. Certainly it's nicer if we get the higher frequencies, but the guts of what we're saying is communicated just between 400 and 5,000 cycles per second. So in essence, it is a combination of both theories, both mechanisms operating, and it depends on the frequency of the incoming stimulation as to what we're actually going to experience at a given time. Now, I want to do a demonstration. I didn't prep the grounds crew for this, but we're going to do it. What I'd like to have is somebody who's got good 20/20 uncorrected hearing come up on stage here with me for a minute, and I'm going to outweight you. We're wasting $20,000 valuable airtime. Got somebody with good hearing? Everybody in the class is going, what? So we're going to get a chair, and we're going to ask you to sit up on the chair on stage. You're going to be there. What I'm going to do is to kneel down in front of you. I'm going to ask you, I'm trying to demonstrate something relative to the position of your head. In fact, why don't we turn just a little sideways so that turn the other way if you would. Let's go that way, and then people can see what I'm doing while they can see what you're doing. What I'm going to do is to click my finger in a variety of spots. I'm going to want you to hold your head still because I'm trying to demonstrate something relative to head position. When we start, I'm going to ask you to close your eyes, and what I want you to do is point as rapidly as you can straight arm so we can see where you're pointing, okay? So again, hold your head still, close your eyes, and now just point as rapidly as you can. My clicker isn't working too well. Okay, hold on just a second. I'm going to get one other thing here, and what I'm going to do is to ask you to form a tube and just hold it up, use your hand to seal right against your ear. Your choice of ears. Yeah. No, just go ahead and go with that. Okay, looking straight at me again. Look where you're pointing. You're pointing over here, and the click was dead center. How long have you had this problem? That's it. Okay, that'll do it. Thanks. In essence, what we've demonstrated there is what is called auditory localization, which is a skill that all of us have. And the point is that there are actually three different cues that your ear and mind use when we're... bet you want me to keep this on today, don't you? There are actually three different cues that we're using when we are when we're locating sound in the environment. Later today, shut your ears when somebody when somebody walks past, and you can locate exactly where they are by the sound of their steps or if they're talking without any problem. There are three cues that we use. One is difference in onset time. That is, if a sound is way over on one side, this ear starts firing before this one does. So there's a difference in onset time. Secondly, there's a difference in loudness, because the head casts what is called a sound shadow. So if you've got a sound way over on one side, the head casts a sound shadow, particularly for higher frequencies, meaning that this ear hears a louder image than this ear does. Okay, it reacts to a louder stimulus than the further away ear does. And thirdly, although this one is subtle, there is a phase difference. That is, if we think about both ears as being at rest until the signal reaches it, what happens is this one, for a sound that's over here, this one starts processing before the other one does. So you get this kind of an effect. There is a difference, there's a phase difference between the two ears. That is the most subtle of the three cues. You notice that when I was out to either side, he could point very rapidly and very accurately to where the sound was coming from. But when I was dead center, when I was clicking straight on, there were two things that were different. First of all, his accuracy deteriorated, because you notice he was covering about a 45 degree range at different times when he was pointing. And secondly, his latency went way up. There were several times when he would think for a second or so before he would actually point. And the reason is that all three of the cues that we normally use have been eliminated when it's directly in front of you. The onset time is identical, the loudness is identical, and both ears are working in phase with each other. What happened when we added the extra foot to his ear? My 12-year-old would love that. You didn't put a foot on his ear. Yeah. Basically, we replicated the situation, and you notice what happened was he pointed over here. In essence, what would have happened had he not had that extra foot-long extension, what would have happened is the sound, had it been over here, would have taken longer to reach this ear than this ear. And so by adding that 1 foot travel time over here, we forced a stimulus, which as you saw was dead center, to take longer to get in, which is exactly what would have happened if the sound had been over here. Okay, so in essence, what we've demonstrated there are the three cues that are normally used for auditory localization or stereo location, brought about by the fact that your ears are separated by 6 inches or so. Witness, your stereo requires 2 speakers to create a true stereo effect. You can't get stereo out of 1 speaker. The final thing we can talk about here is deafness. Deafness basically is the primary problem that we have with hearing. And it occurs normally in 1 of 2 forms. If we hinder transmission in the outer or the middle ear, then what you have is what is called conduction deafness. Conduction deafness, if we were to test your sensitivity, produces a general muting. That is, if perfect hearing is here, with conduction deafness, all of the frequencies are going to be suppressed. You're going to be less sensitive to them. 20 decibel, 30 decibel, 40 decibel loss. I had a friend in high school that we thought was going deaf, because we were having to talk louder and louder and louder to make ourselves heard, and he was complaining about not being able to hear things that the rest of us could hear perfectly well. And everybody was quite worried at the time until he went and had an exam of his ears, and it turned out, much to his embarrassment, that he took a lot of showers in high school, but he wasn't particularly good about rinsing off. And the net result was that what he had done was to build up soap plugs in his ears, and he had about 3/8 of an inch of solid soap, according to the audiologist, in both ears. And it had just gradually closed down and eventually eliminated the auditory canal, or blocked it, so that in essence he was listening through about a 3/4 inch bar of soap on each side of his forehead. And the net result was that it was very easy to fix, much to his embarrassment, just rinse his ears. And after that, things were fine. But the problem was that then he had to wear earphones for about a week, because his hearing had adjusted itself to absolutely, it had maximized its sensitivity. And the result was, afterwards, riding to school, he literally had to wear earplugs because just the everyday city traffic was too loud for him. So in essence, wash your ears is the lesson. And finally then, nerve deafness, which is more often caused by a problem either in the inner ear, either in the inner ear or somewhere in the nerves or up in the temporal lobe where the hearing auditory signals are processed. That will produce what is called a high-end roll-off. That is, you'll be fine at the lower frequencies, but then there'll be a fairly rapid drop off to where you can't hear anything at all. Many years ago, the year I was on leave at Stanford, I had a student who came up after lecture and said, "Where did you get my record?" When I put a particular graph on the board showing somebody that lost almost all hearing at about 250 cycles per second. And that was her hearing problem. She had had a misdiagnosed middle ear problem during late elementary school, about fifth or sixth grade. So she was perfect to talk to because she had heard all the things that you and I hear, but she just no longer could. She could only hear a very little bit. And her friends were kind of teasing her when we were talking to her about it, about the condition afterwards, saying, "Well, you like to dance. You're at all our dances." And she said, "Well, yes, but if you imagine listening to a rock band where only the drummer is playing, that's about what I'm reacting to. If there's no pronounced drum beat, I can't dance. But I can hear the drums, the very bass instruments I can hear, and that's all." But that was a classic example of a nerve deafness. I'm mumbling because I'm trying to get ahead of myself here and move to the next segment of slides, which will give us then moving into the skin senses and the other senses, basically. So we'll start with this and see what this looks like. And hopefully now we can go back to some having some pictures for you for a while. I'm so technically sophisticated here. Hang on just a second. We can get what we need, which is that. And now we're ready to go. The other senses. We're going to start, first of all, with smell. The stimulus for smell, of course, is gas. And it has several different physical characteristics that we can talk about. Specifically, the characteristics that are involved are the chemical nature of the stimulus itself. Now I'm trying to find where in my notes I had the characteristics that I wanted to actually talk to you about. And in fact, what we may do is simply come back to those. Give me a second, we'll catch up with ourselves here. The system that is actually operating in this case involves what kind of theory are we proposing actually operates. The sense of smell turns out to be among the most difficult senses to study. The problem being, of course, that it's located way up in the center part of our head. One of the early theories, which turned out to be wrong, is what's called the Henning smell prism, proposed by Henning back 90 some odd years ago now. And he proposed that in essence it was our sense of smell was anchored by these six basic smells that you see here. And that basically what he was arguing was that you could combine any one, two, three, up to six of these smells and produce the resulting smell that you and I would get from any standard substance. The problem was that he was not able to replicate this either within subjects or, more importantly, across subjects. So this, although it looks fascinating, did not turn out to be the correct answer in terms of how it works. So the Henning smell prism is good for historical purposes, but it doesn't really describe how our sense of smell works. The other theory, which actually has had quite a positive impact, was originally proposed almost 50 years ago now, by Amour, an investigator at the University of Florida. What he proposed is what's called the stereochemical theory. And in essence, the stereochemical theory is also referred to as the lock and key theory. What he's basically arguing is that on the receptor surface, there is a molecule outfacing, that is on up in your nose in an area that we'll get to here in a couple of minutes. There is a molecule facing outward. And anytime a properly shaped molecule catches up with or intercepts that and locks in, it stimulates that cell and causes the neuron then to fire. The reason it's called a lock and key theory is because of the fact that it doesn't matter, as long as the molecule that is floating around in the air has the proper element to it so that it will mesh with that receptor site, it doesn't matter what else happens to be attached to it, okay? It doesn't matter what else happens to be attached to it. It will, you know, it can have basically anything attached to it as long as it has that proper interface to fire the system. The net result, or the parallel, the reason it's called a lock and key theory, is to suggest about the key that you use to get into your house or your dorm room, wherever you're staying. And that is that it doesn't matter whether that key is aluminum or copper or gold or whatever, as long as the shape is correct, it will turn and operate the lock. The lock and key theory is arguing the same way. That is, that there are a certain base number of smells that we have, and as long as that molecule comes in the receptor element, it will in fact fire it, even though there may be quite a wide variety of different chemicals that could be attached to it under those circumstances. So basically, the lock and key theory then is the best example that we have for studying the nose. And the receptor site is as indicated here. There are bones filling the nasal cavity, but the actual receptor site for our sense of smell is right at the top of the nasal cavity there, an area called the olfactory epithelium. Okay? When you're breathing quietly, the air simply goes in across the bottom of your the bottom of your nasal cavity right down into your throat. Okay? You breathe quietly, the sense adapts quite rapidly, and you're really not even smelling things. Many years ago, I was at the Tower Theater attending the Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, the original stage version of that. And during the course of the show, they had a problem with the air conditioning system. There was a minor fire, not in the theater, but in the building next to it, in the system that air conditioned the theater. The first awareness that I had that that had happened was when I heard the audience on the main floor. I was up in the balcony because I was an assistant professor at the time, associate professor, poor. Of course, that's no different. I guess ranked, well, it's a separate issue. The point was that I was hearing people go, and when you get 1,000 people simultaneously going, you'll hear it. And in fact, that was the, it was kind of sweeping from the front of the auditorium back. And that, but in essence, what they were doing is sniffing. And that's exactly what you and I do anytime we want to smell something. So in essence, what you're doing when you sniff is you're bringing air in through nostrils that are a fixed size. I mean, we can adjust them a little bit by flaring, but not much. So the net result is when you go, what happens is the air that comes through that fixed orifice expands when it gets into the olfactory epithelium. So when you go, the air comes in and swirls up into the upper reaches of the olfactory epithelium, and therefore you get a richer smell. So anytime you sniff, the reason you can smell things better is because more of the air that's going into your throat is wafting up by the olfactory epithelium. Now, it turns out the sense of smell adapts very rapidly. So if you're ever hiking in the woods and you get sprayed by a skunk, do not stand there saying, I smell like, because in essence you will. And every time you go, you're freshening the stimulation. What you want to do instead is just stand there quietly and breathe quietly. Your friends will still hate you, but at least you don't have to suffer with it. Just let the rapid adaptation of the sense of smell actually work there. While we're on this diagram, let me also show you that when you have a common cold, what happens is that a lot of the nasal cavity there fills with mucus. And the net result is that when you sniff, about the only thing you're running into is mucus, which tends to block the sniff and therefore totally coats the olfactory epithelium. And that's the reason that things are kind of bland when you're eating, is that the sense of smell has been blocked. I'll show you the link here a little bit later. But that's the sense of smell. The receptor there, of course, is the nose. The hair cells are actually, here's the second time that we've seen hair cells operating. The olfactory epithelium actually has hair cells on them, on it. With the molecules to which we can react hanging off it, hanging off them. So in essence, this is the second of several times we're going to see hair cell-like mechanisms responsible for transducing signals from one form to another. The functions we've already talked about. Let's look now at taste, which is the second major chemical sense. And here, the physical stimulus is, in this case, of course, liquid. The physical characteristics that are involved, and let me remind you again, as we had the argument in hearing the other day, are not the same as the psychological attributes, but we have four fairly well-defined physical characteristics in taste. And those are, first of all, salt ions. The plus and minus ions of salt will give us a salty taste, so that we know quite precisely that that is what causes the salty taste that we experience. Secondly, complex organic compounds will give us the sense of sweet. That one has been somewhat more difficult to spell out. We do know that it involves carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen in a fairly complex organic molecule basic substance, or substrate if you want. But we don't have a precise formula for sugars per se. it is nonetheless complex organic compounds that are involved. Thirdly, and this one may surprise you, the H+ ions of acids give us the taste of sour. Now, what that's basically arguing is that if we can block your sense of smell, we could drop hydrochloric acid on your tongue, nitric acid. I mean, we'll dilute it enough so it's not going to burn down through your chin. But if we take dilute substances of any acid and drop it on your tongue so that you, in a way such that you cannot smell it, they'd all taste the same. And that turns out to be true, that it's the H+ ions of acids that produce the sour taste. And in fact, all acids taste the same. What differentiates, you know, you think, well, I can tell the difference when they put nitric acid in my swimming pool or sulfuric acid or hydrochloric. No, it's not taste that gives you that differentiating skill. It is smell that actually does so. Finally, then, alkaloids are generally what tend to cause the taste bitter. That's been the least easy to identify all the way around in the study of smell. Now, the receptors that are actually involved, and this is deceptive, there are actually three that are involved. The papillae are one element. The papillae are basically the lumps that you see on your tongue. Okay, those are the larger lumps that you see on your tongue. If you actually look at those lumps, they are constituted of a cluster of taste buds. Okay, and the taste buds actually are constituted of gustatory or taste cells. So in essence, the mechanism as a whole looks like this. It looks almost a cross section of a taste bud looks exactly like you cut an onion crosswise. It's got that same kind of bellied shape in the middle with everything clustering toward the top. You'll notice again there are hair-like cells involved in this mechanism. The taste neurons are the gustatory cells, and those are the individual cells within the diagram here, which connect to the taste nerve and relay the information to the brain. That is where the transduction actually takes place. That is, the chemical reaction has to be in liquid form in order for us to taste it. In order to smell it, it has to be in gaseous form. In order to taste it, it has to be in liquid form. And the net result then is that we have a wide variety of sensitivities to these different tastes, as indicated here. And I'll just give you the full table straight out. But in essence, we can taste salt with about one part in 30. That is the taste to which we are least sensitive. The one to which we are most sensitive is bitter, likely because, or perhaps resulting from the fact that the sour and the bitter tastes are the ones that are most likely to include things that will poison us. Certainly there are some good tasting things that can poison us, like mushrooms. But my bet is that the reason we are so sensitive to the sour and bitter is the fact that those tend to be key elements of things that will hurt you if you eat them. And so you want to be able to react to them very efficiently under those kind of conditions. Whoops. Well, we'll back out of there. We'll come back to me for a minute, and we will move on into a second set of information here. Give me just a second so I can do my delicate look at my elbow balancing act here again for a second. And then what we'll do is to look at the following diagram. And in essence, what that will show us is the relative proportion of the four basic tastes that are represented by some fairly common household products that you may have tasted at foods. We could even call them not household products, foods. And you can see that there is quite a range of mixtures of these that occur. This is one example of a sense like vision, where there seems to be an interaction between each of the different raw sensors or experiences producing the very complex interactions that we get among things ranging as widely as from Coca-Cola to Coke drinks, cola drinks, I should say, to unsweetened grapefruit juice and all the range in between there. The common problem that we have in this particular system is the common cold. When your boyfriend or girlfriend invites you for supper and you decline by saying, it'll be a waste of your money, I have a cold, I can't taste anything, you're actually lying. You taste perfectly well. Your taste is not hindered by a cold. What is hindered is your sense of smell. And in fact, therein lies the secret to the fact that we call them the chemical senses. That is, we tend to think of smell and taste and refer to smell and taste together because, in fact, they operate together. And in fact, if you were to take or have somebody drop on your tongue when you have a cold, a piece of apple, a piece of potato, you cannot tell the difference because texturally they're very similar when you chew them. You cannot taste any difference between those two. There may be a substantial difference in the smell, but that's what normally allows you to identify it. You can't actually detect it when you have a common cold. Now let's go on and look at the skin senses. That is, as it turns out, the largest organ in terms of sensing what goes on in the body are the skin senses. Collectively, they represent quite a wide range of different types of stimuli to which we react. Again, a reminder that the physical characteristics I'm talking about are not related to the psychological attributes. I'm going to keep saying that until it eventually sinks in. One is any contact. For that, we get the sense of touch. There are sensors on the surface of the arm, on the body, that in fact react to touch. If your boyfriend or girlfriend touches you anywhere, however lightly, you still react to it. You can sense when it's happening. Secondly, if you get heavy contact, the difference, and if we can come back to me for just a second here, the difference is that if we look at just barely touching, then we're talking about touch. But if we're talking about pushing in, you can see, of course, that there is a wide area of skin that is depressed on your arm under those conditions. So in essence, heavy contact will yield the experience of pressure as opposed to touch. Thirdly, we have temperature below skin temperature. That gives us the experience of cool. And we have temperature above skin temperature, which gives us the sense of heat. Now, there are several examples of the interactions that take place in the skin senses. For instance, if you grab something that has, well, for instance, let's suppose that we take a stimulus where we take a tube, say a quarter inch or half inch copper tube, and twist it around a pole, have a second copper tube separate, also twisted around the pole. We run one set of water that's 10 degrees above skin temperature through the one tube, and the other tube we run cool water that is 10 degrees below room temperature. So we've got the two twisted around each other. If you grab that pole, or that those two tubes simultaneously, you will not be able to hold on because the experience that you get is of searing heat. In other words, you will perceive that as if you are burning yourself. Pretty good evidence of the fact that what we get is a complex of interactions between the four separate sensors for the sense of touch, and that various interactions give you various kinds of experiences. For instance, we do not have a receptor for wet, if you think about it. When you put your hand in a bucket of water, the only thing that you actually get is a gradient. There's a pressure gradient around your arm at the edge of the water, and there is the difference in temperature between the water and the air. But you don't actually put your hand in and say, oh, wet. What you do is react to the temperature and the pressure gradient when you've got your hand in water. You think about diving in a swimming pool. You get that very pleasant sensation across the surface of your skin. But what you're actually reacting to is bubbles and water pressure on your skin. There is no wet touch per se. It's a combination of pressure and temperature that is involved. Therein lies another very interesting experiment. If we have a bucket of water that is at room temperature here in front of us, we have to the one side a bucket of cool water where we've just dumped in enough ice cubes to drop it about 10 degrees below the ambient temperature. Question.
What about, like, you can feel when you sweat, like you can feel that wet? I mean, what is that?
Again, I'm going to argue that you're not feeling it wet. What you're feeling is pressure and the fact that you're hot. In that case, it's hot and the feel. You know, when you're in a nervous situation and you feel something running down your ribs from your armpits, it's that what you're feeling is the touch. You're feeling the actual touch of the drop of water, not wet. Want to bet? No, there is no wet sensor per se. There is not. Gonna have to trust me on that. Would I lie to you? Would I lie to you? Probably. It is weird, but we're talking only fact here, not weird. So we've got our room temperature bucket, we've got our cool bucket, and we've got a slightly warmed bucket. So we've got minus 10 degrees from room temperature, and plus 10. We put our hands, one in the cool, one in the warm, and we let them adapt for about 2 or 3 minutes. And then right in front of your eyes, we're going to take both hands, put them into the bucket that has the room temperature water, The hand that was in the cool is going to tell you this bucket is warm. The hand that is warm, that was in the warm water, is going to tell you that this bucket is cool, even though you're looking at both hands in one bucket of water. One is going to report that it's cool if it's been in hot, and the one that's been in cool is going to report that it's hot. Oh, did I mix that up? If it's been in cool, it's going to report the room temperature water, which is slightly warmer, as hot. And if it's been in hot, when it goes into the cooler room temperature water, it's going to report it as cold. Okay? The point is, the temperature on the body is always judged relative to what is called physiological zero. That is the body temperature at any point on the body at a given time or at a point of measurement. Okay? For instance, when you're out brushing leaves in the dead of winter, when it gets bitingly cold here in Houston, you're like down to 40. If you were doing that at 25 or 30, your earlobes could potentially ultimately be frostbitten. But let's suppose you come in after you've been outside brushing leaves for quite a while and it's 35 degrees. Your earlobes may be very close to 35, 37, 40 degrees. They're quite cool because the circulation, particularly as you age, is not particularly good there. At that point, if we hold up an ice cube next to your earlobe, you will experience it as almost room temperature, slightly cool, but you certainly won't perceive it as cold as you would on a hot summer day when somebody drops an ice cube down the back of your bathing suit. Okay? Again, it's physiological zero that determines how we react to various kinds of temperature. Now, one of the ways to measure and demonstrate the intensity of innervation of the touch sensors on the body is to measure what is called a two-point threshold. I'll suggest a very simple experiment for you to try on yourself later. When you have two pencils, what you do is to hold them in such a way that the points are actually coming together. I can't do it because maybe I can with the points off. Maybe we can do a top-down demonstration here, and I'll show you what I'm talking about. If they can go to the overhead camera, I'll show you what I'm talking about. What I want you to do is to hold the pens so that the points are actually together here. All right? See, if we do it this way, we've already got something that's about half an inch apart. What I want you to do is to hold it this way when you do the test, and I want you to have both pens in the same hand as I've got, okay? The reason being that when we actually touch the skin, we want both points, and of course it didn't work when I tried to demonstrate it. We want both tips to touch simultaneously. Okay? So it's very important that you hold them in this way so that the two tips touch together when you actually do so. We'll just put a smiley face on there and then we'll come back to me now. In essence, what you're going to measure is two-point threshold. And if you measure on the arm, up here on the forearm, you will be able to hold those pens about an inch apart. You'll be able to have the tips about that far apart. And if you do it very carefully, touching on someone's arm, they'll be about an inch. Now, what you're going to do is you're going to have them shut their eyes, and you're going to say, ready, and then within a couple of seconds, you touch them. But you'll start, perhaps, with an ascending series. You start with the points closer together. You gradually space them further apart. And at about that distance, you will find that when you touch them, they will now report two rather than one. Make sure, if they're friends, that you touch them occasionally with just one to keep them honest. If they keep saying two too often, that means that they're not making the actual judgment. They're just knowing that you're holding two objects most of the time. Now, try it on the fingertips. And in that case, you're going to have to do that thing where you point inward. All right? Because on the fingertips, you can actually get down to about a 16th of an inch apart, and your subject will still be able to detect the difference, as long as you're touching them equally. Again, the point is you don't want to give a temporal cue. You don't want one of these things, okay? You want to make sure that both points touch evenly at the same point. Now, I want you to go to the lower center part of the back, and there you will find, or on the lower back part of the leg, you can actually get the points up to about 4 inches apart. And they will still, if they touch with equal pressure and consistently, you'll find that they will still report only one up until you get to be about 4 inches apart under those circumstances. So your homework assignment tonight is to do a complete two-point body map touch threshold of your significant other. I'll want to see the data on next lecture. I said that with a straight face one time. A student actually turned one in. Must have been a great date. I don't ask. I just take the homework.
Will you get extra credit?
Will you get extra credit? Yeah, but it's going to be them that gives it to you. Okay, in essence, The transduction process, we've already talked about a little bit, the different cells that are reacting there. The functions are numerous, but essentially they are there to give you spatial orientation, to allow you to know when things are touching you that are good or bad or different. One of the other purposes is pain. I'm going to come back and cover pain in the section on motivation and motion, so although this would be an obvious place to do so, I'm going to hold off on it until later. But that is the primary pain or the primary problem that we have with the skin senses. But we're not done yet. We actually have several others that we can also review with you. One of them is proprioception, which involves, among other things, the vestibular sense. And the vestibular sense actually is reacting to or is utilizing, among others, the semicircular canals. And those semicircular canals react basically, I remind you again, the physical characteristics are not the same as the psychological attribute. But the physical stimulus that they react to is any motion. And the experience that you get is movement. Is movement. Okay? Example. If we put you on a swivel chair and turn you around very steadily this way, what will happen is that you will experience movement. And that's happening because of the semicircular canals. Okay? We're going to go back to those for just a minute. You will see just above the middle, the inner ear, those three loops. Those are the three channels of the semicircular canals. And if you look very closely, you will see, certainly in the tallest one of the three that's labeled there, you can see the swelling on the right-hand loop just about when it re-enters the main chamber there. Within that swelling is a crystalline structure, and the loop is actually closed and complete. There is a crystalline structure that floats within that area. And the following happens. The same fluids that fill the cochlea also fill the inner part of the semicircular canals. One is located roughly left to right, one is located roughly front to back, and one is located roughly flat to the earth, so that you can detect movement in any particular direction. On the canal that is flat, when you start moving in the circular manner I was demonstrating a minute ago, what happens is the body itself moves. I mean, when I start turning this way, my entire head and all the apparatus within it turns. The result is that the canal itself, the semicircular canal, turns. But the fluid within it and the crystalline structure that is floating within that fluid do not turn. So the result is when my head turns, that canal comes this way, and therefore the edge of the canal bumps into the crystalline structure. In other words, that crystalline structure is floating in that larger chamber. It floats here. You've got a complete circle of fluid here. And when we start turning, the fluid does not turn through inertia. And so what happens is that the cell, the crystalline structure, bumps the cell on this side, and therefore you experience it as if you're turning this way. But now what happens if we keep turning you? If we turn you slowly but steadily this direction for 3 or 4 minutes, you know what happens? The fluid in the canal catches up. Now your canal and the fluid and the crystalline structure, which has recentered itself, are all floating as a unit. And so now all of a sudden, if you are stopped suddenly, the fluid keeps going. So now within this area, the crystalline structure now bumps the other direction. And there, that's the reason why if you turn for any length of time in one direction, when you stop, you experience it as if you're turning in the opposite direction, even though in fact you are not. Here is yet another example of where your brain is lying to you. Okay? When you turn consistently in one direction and then stop, the fluid catches up and then gives you the misimpression that you're actually turning in the opposite direction. It's a compensatory experience. And in fact, it's wrong. It simply is not correct. So we've got an example there of yet another instance where the brain is actually lying to you. Now, let's look also, in addition to the semicircular canals, we've also got the otolith organs, which I'm not going to spend a great deal of time talking about. Again, the physical characteristic I'm describing here is not equal to the psychological attribute. And in this case, what it's reacting to is basically any motion of the body. And the sense there, again, the psychological attribute that you get out of it, the experience that you get, is that of movement. You can, of course, overstimulate. That's one of the things that happens in the visual sense. And it's the semicircular canals that actually give us the information that we have here. Now what I'm going to do is to demonstrate the following for you. What I'd like you to do is to hold your hand up in front of you, and I want you to, we're going to do two different things with it. In one case, what I want you to do is to move just your eyes, okay? You're going to move just your eyes, and you're going to move it back and forth. And you know the lines on your hands? What I want you to do is keep those focused. So as you move your hand back and forth, don't move your head, just move your eyes. Okay? Now stop. Now do the same thing moving your hand, but move your head with it. In other words, you're going to keep your eyes still and move your head instead. Which way are the lines clearer? The first way or the second way? Second way. Try it again, but the second way is the way it will be clearer. The reason is that you've got two systems working now rather than one. You've got the visual system because of the background moving, which lets you know there is motion involved, but when you're cranking your head back and forth, you're also affecting the semicircular canals. In other words, that second sense has kicked in there, and you end up with a more complex interaction there. In essence, therein lies the solution to kids who get car sick. And that is, the reason they get car sick is because they're below the horizon, meaning they're below the windowsill, down deep in the back seat. They can't see what's going on, but they're constantly being jostled. And therefore, their semicircular canals eventually get tired. I'm personifying it more than I should here. But in essence, it's the absence of visual stimulation that leads to car sickness. So the solution that your mom always says, oh, come up here and sit on mama's lap, okay, is a perfectly good solution. Because in essence, what happens is it gets you up higher because you're now sitting on her lap. You're sitting in the front seats, which are higher. And 9 times out of 10, your eyes can now see the horizon, the distant horizon. And although your body is moving just as much, because you've now got the visual anchor outside the car, you don't tend to be as sick. So even though you're still moving, you don't tend to be nearly as car sick because you've added in that second sense. Just an indication of the interaction that we do get among the various senses that are involved. Now, let's also look at the kinesthetic sense and cover this at least very briefly. By the way, the name of the thing that I just gave you there is what's called the vesticular ocular reflex. I meant to give you that title, but that's the title of it. The vesticular ocular reflex is what's going on there. Finally then, if we look at the kinesthetic sense, the physical characteristic that is involved here is not equal to the psychological attribute. I hope we're going to sink that lesson in eventually here. Now what we're doing is basically any body movement, and in this case what you have is what is called body sense. There are a wide variety of receptors for this. There are 4 sensors at least that have been identified. One is in the muscles, 2 separate ones are on the tendons of the body, and one of them is in the joints of your body. The net result of this sense is that if I want to, what I can do is ask you, I could ask any one of you to shut your eyes, or at home right now if you're watching television, shut your eyes and describe for me or for yourself the position of your body. And you can do so. You know whether your arm's hanging out or not. You know whether you're holding a pen or not. You know whether your legs are crossed or not crossed. You know whether your head's tipped left or right, back or forward. I mean, it's all the way back and you're asleep. You're missing this whole demonstration, but anything's possible. The point being that in essence, The kinesthetic sense is the one that gives us our sense of body. That is our ability to locate where the body actually is. That is the one that cooperates with the visual sense when somebody's throwing something at you. That is, you're using your body sense to know where the body is and then when to close the hands to catch the ball and so forth. Okay, we're going to switch into the fifth section now on basics of perception and at least get a launch here so that maybe we can cover most of it by next time. And in essence, what we're going to start with is a series of slides that we will show you. The first of these is going to cover or make the following point for you. I just want to remind you that there is never, the whole idea of separating physical characteristics from psychological attributes is the fact that there is never an exact correspondence between what we observe in the physical world and the psychological attributes that we benefit from. The phantom limb phenomenon is a classic example of that. Somebody who's had an accident or a war injury or any kind of illness who has a limb separated from them will sometimes report afterwards feeling tickles and so forth in a part of the body that they know is no longer there. The point being that the sense itself is separate from the physical sensor. And it's the sense that you're reacting to in that case that you are still experiencing. The next slide shows you one other phenomenon, and that is that the relationship between physical phenomena and perceptual experience is separate. What you're seeing here is a picture of me looking into a searchlight, which has many different lenses all focused on the element. And once I give you that explanation, you can perceive it more accurately, which we'll talk about next time.